Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, where this weekly, as the world speeds up, we slow down. As the din rises, we go quiet, at least within the limits of radio, where beds are made of sound and silence is extinction. Later on, we'll meditate on sleep with the artist who created an all-night sleeping soundtrack for radio and the computer scientist who measures 40 winks. But we begin with poet and author Jane Brocks. Brocks, whose previous book explored what electric light has done to our minds and our world, has written Silence, a social history of one of the least understood elements of our lives. In her book, Brock looks at prisons and monasteries and spaces in between to seek out silence, but also to let it creep up on her.
I'm Jane Brocks. I'm a writer living in Brunswick, Maine, in the United States, and I've just published a book on silence. It's a social history of silence, having to do with the monastery and the penitentiary and the different silences found within those institutions.
You are very specifically looking at those institutions, but it drives us back to our own lives. And I was kind of thinking, well, what, like people often ask, what is your relationship with alcohol to an Irish person? So what is my relationship to silence? So what is your relationship to silence?
Well, that's interesting. As a writer, of course, I depend on silence for my work. I can't imagine writing without it, not only while I'm writing, but in the time before and afterwards, to let ideas roam, to let my thoughts settle. Silence to me is the space in which my work can thrive, I think.
Many of the people in your book talk of it as a substance that's sort of slightly unfamiliar, that something that could strip you or crush you or coat you. And all of those kind of people who have had intense experience of silence seem to view it as something quite unusual or quite different from perhaps the way we viewed it.
Yes, I think that's true. I think of silence as something that's unstable, that it can change from minute to minute. And my relationship to it can change from minute to minute. It can be rewarding, it can be frustrating. And I've experienced a remote silence on an island where I lived in my early 20s that was frightening to me, and which felt every day as if I was contending with silence. And so maybe that was the origin of the book, in that kind of enormous silence 40 years ago.
Tell us a little bit about that island. Where was it and what were you doing there?
I was just out of college. It was Nantucket Island off the coast of Massachusetts, and I was trying to form my life, trying to shape my life. So that, I think, was part of the reason the silence felt so enormous. I felt lost within it.
Did you realize straight away that it was the silence that was giving you that kind of feeling? Because sometimes it's difficult to, and often in your book, I think, I'm thinking, well, there's many things rolled up into that idea of silence you're talking about.
I think in the process over the 6 years of writing the book, I came to see silence as something incredibly complex, that every silence has the capacity to reward as well as to strip us bare.
The penitentiary that you're particularly looking at is a penitentiary that was built at the beginning of the 19th century outside Philadelphia, Eastern State Penitentiary.
It was the vision of one of the United States' founding fathers, Benjamin Rush, who was a Philadelphia Quaker. He imagined each prisoner submitting to silence and solitude for a specific length of time and having some spiritual guidance would eventually find redemption and come to atone for his sins and return to society a new man. I think it's best understood in relation to what had come before the idea of the penitentiary, which was the blood punishments, hanging, branding, and whipping. And the United States was looking for a new kind of criminal justice. And Benjamin Rush, for decades, supported the idea of the penitentiary, and it eventually came to fruition after his death in 1829. This punishment was entirely secluded and private in the penitentiary. It was the opposite of what the blood punishments that had begun in Europe and then were used in colonial America, of the public crowding around the public hangings and whippings, and Rush saw that as detrimental to the citizens as much as it was nothing that fostered redemption for the prisoner. So it was bad for society at large. But it was also true at this time that a lot of Enlightenment thinking in Europe centered on prison reform or criminal justice reform. The jails at the time, which were used only to house criminals before their trials or debtors, were crowded and filthy places where they were dinny and noisy, and young criminals were at the behest of older criminals and could be influenced by them. And Rush was looking also to silence that kind of influence with the penitentiary, that if each prisoner could be away from the influence of other criminals, then he would have a better chance at redemption.
You bring us into Eastern State Penitentiary in the company of Charles Williams. When he went to the prison, where was he put? What did he find?
Charles Williams, prisoner number one, was an 18-year-old black farmer who stole $25 worth of gold from a household and was convicted of that crime. And he was sentenced to 2 years of silent and solitary confinement at Eastern State. So when he arrived in the late fall of 1829, it was like entering a monastery. There was a ritual where he was washed. His clothes were changed. He was no longer called by his name. He was called prisoner number one and would be for the 2 years he was there. That was what was over his cell, just the number one. And he was brought into an 8-by-12-foot stone cell. The guards wore wool socks over their boots so that he wouldn't even hear the guards bringing his lunch. He wouldn't even hear them approaching the cell. And the lunch cart itself had leather wheels so that it made no noise. So he wouldn't know his meal was coming until it was slipped through the slot. There was one light in the one window in the ceiling, around an 8-inch round window, which was enough light to read the New Testament by. Benjamin Rush was really basing his idea of the penitentiary cell on the monastic cell. But what he didn't take into consideration was the monastic cell was intimately tied with the idea of community. A monk would be in his cell for a certain amount of time during the day, but each day was also involved being together with other monks. The human voice was everywhere in the monastery. They sang, they chanted, they said prayers, and they even conversed with each other. What was inherently awful about the penitentiary was the unmitigated silence and solitude, the 24 hours of silence and solitude every day, which I think is untenable for almost every human being. You know, very few people came out of that unscathed. What I came away from the research with is that even in these institutions, the experience was very different for women than it was for men. In the penitentiary, for instance, there were no cells provided for women at the beginning of the penitentiary because women weren't the kind of women who were convicted of crimes weren't thought capable of redemption. So in a way, it wouldn't be appropriate for a fallen woman to seek redemption within the penitentiary. So that's a sort of a downgrading of the idea of a woman's humanity. And within the monastery, in a medieval monastery, the women were not there often by choice. They were often put there because they were unmarriageable or because they were the third daughter and there was no place for them in the world, so they were put in the monastery. But both institutions, the silence meant something very different for women. Women didn't have control of their lives within the monasteries the way men did, and they were always controlled by men. Even today, for instance, you know, the women in convents can't say mass. A man has to come in and say mass within their convents.
When we're talking about the monastic tradition of silence, we sort of think that that is a medieval thing, but it's something that endured into the 20th century with Thomas Merton.
Yes, it's interesting. I have been reading Thomas Merton since my early 20s. I'm 62 now, so almost 40 years I've been reading him. I kept going back to his work over the years. But when I began this book, I didn't think of him as having a central place within it. But as I went back to reread him, he articulates so much, I think, the struggle to find silence, to maintain silence, and what silence means. Silence for him, likewise, wasn't something stable. And so I think his contention with it is very rich. His writing about it is beautiful. So I had to use him as a central figure. And I wanted to humanize the topic in the way Charles Williams stood for the penitentiary's silence. I wanted Thomas Merton to stand for the monastic silence.
He was quite popular in mid-century America as a writer, but maybe people don't know of his work now.
His autobiography, which he entered the monastery on the eve of America's entry into World War II, so in the 1940s, and he promptly wrote, at the urging of his abbot, wrote his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, which became an international bestseller, much to everyone's surprise. And it thrust him into the spotlight reluctantly, and he never became an obscure monk. He never gained the kind of obscurity he was looking for entering the monastery. In fact, his fame followed him to the end of his days. He was widely read. He also contended with silence in a very complex way in the 1950s and 60s with the buildup of the Cold War and with the civil rights struggles in the United States, because he felt that the silence he had so long sought was untenable in such times, that he, as a writer, was called to speak out against the nuclear buildup, against war, and for civil rights. So he had there's a very interesting and complex struggle that goes on in Merton's life between silence and speech.
Again, he kind of gets at what the definition of silence is, because he is definitely very into environmental sounds and, you know, what R. Murray Schafer would call the soundscape. And he dwelt in that and concentrated on it. And yet he felt that silence was what he was dealing with.
There's a beautiful comment by the American composer John Cage, who says, "Silence is not acoustic. It's a change of mind, a turning around. The natural sounds of the world are part of silence. Silence is something other than the complete absence of noise. And in fact, there isn't a way to escape sound. As John Cage found out when he went into an anechoic chamber, that he could still hear his blood rushing and his heart beating, even in a place that was supposed to be absolutely devoid of sound."
One of the activities that we like to perform in silence is reading, and that's something that interests you a lot.
Yeah, I loved researching the history of reading itself. I decided to include it because it was such an integral part of monastic life. And then as I read about the practice of reading in the monastery, I began to understand, actually, that it's one of the few things that has grown quieter over time, that monastic reading was, in fact, oral, that the monks would pronounce every word as they read. But I also love the idea of them reading one book again and again and really concentrating not on a lot of literature, not reading at speed or reading to consume many books at once, but just to dwell in one book and to understand what that one book meant in the world, and to take the ideas in that book with them to their work and contemplate it while they worked, take it with them into their hours of silence and contemplate it in silence. As an inveterate reader, someone who just loves to read and loves books, to me, that's the highest form of respect for the written word, is to dwell in it in that way.
You evoke this idea of reading as almost a way of weaving silence around ourselves.
some people say, well, reading sort of clouds silence. It brings words and ideas into silence. But I don't think of silence in that way. I think of silence as a place where reading can amplify the silence and enrich it in many ways. And it's that very monastic type of reading where you're dwelling on what's said and you're allowing an exchange with the page rather than the page instructing you on what to do or giving you facts. The reader is in fact in conversation with the page.
Do you think that happens any differently on your iPad or on your phone to when you're holding a piece of paper or a book of paper in your hand?
I always, when I can, read a physical book, because I find that scrolling speeds up my eye, so that I'm always skimming as I scroll, whereas in a book I can read one word at a time. I often hear each word in my head. I read very slowly. I always have. It sometimes is quite frustrating, but I think it's the only way I know how. So I do think that our modern devices do speed up reading, but that's been a process that didn't start with the iPad. That, in fact, Marshall McLuhan would say it started with the printed word, which sped up the eye, and the eye and the ear have been growing further and further apart ever since.
I guess you're interested in the technology of poetry to kind of force reading in a certain way and create that kind of contemplative reading you're talking about.
I myself would love to be able to read prose at the speed of poetry all the time. It's not always possible, but I think that poetry is presents the ultimate opportunity to just dwell on what's on the page and give what's on the page its proper due. Sometimes I think of poetry in silence. Sometimes little snippets of poems come back to me as sort of the music of the language. Silence to me is often a time of listening, yeah.
To the voice inside your head?
Well, to the world itself. It's interesting. I think the silence I think of that's probably the purest is when I'm out walking, say, in the woods or by the ocean by myself, because to me that's the one time where there aren't voices in my head, that I'm just walking along perceiving the world. And to me that's almost the purest kind of silence.
I think you try not to be too apocalyptic about it, but is there a kind of climate change in silence as well, that there's a danger that we're losing some quality of silence?
I remember encountering one person just talking about the subject of silence, and he said, you know, it's something I just never think about. And I was sort of shocked to think, I mean, to me, silence, so much depends on silence. Even the quality of speech depends on silence. Music depends on silence. You can't have a conversation without silence, without the smallest pause to reflect and think. And I think a lot of that is lost because we're bombarded at every hour of the day with not only the human voice, but recorded voices that are both just oral and voices that come at us through the screen. So that sound is inescapable. Sound will always dominate silence. And so I think we have to consciously make a space for silence, and that's not a very easy thing to do.
Jane Brocks there, author of Silence, a social history of one of the least understood elements of our lives. And finally, on this week's Culture File Weekly, we take the silence a little deeper. Sleep. Is there enough of it in our lives? And more importantly, does it have the right soundtrack? To help us dreamily ask those questions, artist Michelle Doyle, whose work includes creating a sleeping soundtrack for all-night radio, and Professor Alan Smeaton, whose work involves what happens when sleep and technology snuggle up together.
Imagine that you're how can ambient music or ambience become like this radical thing, and how can you be radical with technology, sleep? How can you be almost politically engaged as you sleep?
We're very interested in monitoring our health, our exercise, our activity, our step counters. But sleep is just as important, because sleep is a restorative activity for both our minds as well as for our bodies. And our lives are made up of three intersecting activities. We work, we relax, socialize and interact, and then we sleep and recover.
I go to sleep.
My name is Alan Smeaton. I'm a professor of computing here at Dublin City University, where I've been for quite a long while. My interest is in data analysis, data analytics, and I have a particular interest in when that data that I analyze comes from personal data, from wearables or from sensing your environment, and it's associated with an individual. I have always had an interest in sleep. I joke that I've spent about a third of my life asleep, so I'm quite an expert in it. But I've become particularly interested over the last 10 years probably in measuring sleep and quantifying sleep. Because we all wake up in the morning and, you know, we think, did I get a good night's sleep or did I not get a good night's sleep? It's, you know, conversation piece with other people in the morning. And I've been interested in measuring that. So I've been using a range of different technologies as the technologies have evolved to measure and quantify my own sleep.
It's interesting talking about awareness and sleep. Maybe some people dismiss the whole idea of tracking, because the idea about being asleep is that you're supposed to be totally unaware. And that's how you get a good sleep.
Yeah, that's not actually how you get a good night's sleep. A good night's sleep isn't how long you slept. It's the quality of your sleep. And you can get a better restorative sleep from a shorter period than a long night of unrest. So a good night's sleep is a sleep where you have five or six of these cycles where you go into a really, really deep, almost comatose type sleep for a short period of time. And then you return to an almost state of wakefulness. So if you get five or six of those iterations and the deep part is really, really deep, then that's a good night's sleep.
My name is Michelle Doyle and I'm a visual artist and I'm a sound maker. I live in Dublin. I make music solo as Rising Damp, and I make music with a noise performance band called The Healers. I kind of chanced my arm and asked if it was possible that I could go in and do an 8-hour durational performance. I kind of thought, like, you know, what would be really interesting for International Women's Day is to think about labor and time spent doing things. I'm actually the record holder for the longest slot ever done on DDR, ahead of all the men. I went to see Stephen Stapleton from Nurse With Wound down in Open Air Festival. It was maybe about 40 people in a tent with air mattresses, and he was playing a lot of drone with visuals projected on the ceiling. What was so beautiful about it was that it was sound that was being used for something other than active listening, that like sound could kind of become like this environmental tool, and the purpose of it was to help you sleep. And the purpose of the visuals were kind of flickering on your eyes, almost encouraging REM. This is a really revolutionary way to perform, and it's a really revolutionary way to maybe act outside of even capitalism as well, because we do things in these solid blocks, but we don't do things where we give ourselves over and we give our time over for huge amounts of time.
We haven't evolved as a species to take less sleep, but we all get less sleep, and that has a knock-on effect. So I would say that society is worse off as a result of that, and that's just a consequence of it. Can you stop that? Can you change that? It's very hard to reverse a trend like that, because more and more the pressure is to get up earlier, to go to bed late.
I thought, like, wouldn't it be really interesting to combine sleep concert with radio? Radio is a collective listening experience, and you can tune in when you're in bed. I had this vision of myself going in and doing stuff that was really peaceful. And when I went in, I immediately started making very paranoid and strange and eerie tracks. And I was doing spoken word and reading, and I would kind of meditate on certain phrases. Just chanting and like making whole songs out of these ideas. This kind of went on and on, maybe until like 1 or 2 in the morning. And then as night went on, I decided to blow up my bed and I brought my air pump and I put the air pump up to the microphone. And I started blowing up my air mattress and it was really noisy and chaotic. And I saw my listenership whittle down. So after blowing up my mattress, I decided to put on a drone that would help me sleep and help everyone else sleep. I probably went to sleep about like 4 eventually. And at about 7 in the morning, I woke up and I started making music again. I started making actual techno this time because I kind of wanted a sort of Philip Glass response to like the energy of the city. Traffic is moving, people are going to work. So this is a piece that is like a transporter, and I was going to transport people from the drone back to work. I guess like there's this whole thing as well now that like everything has to be doing 2 jobs at once. Even in Dublin, if you own a cafe, your cafe has to be a nightclub at night. When you are walking to work, you can be listening to podcasts and also getting your steps in. And this is like, everything must be 2 things at once or else you're wasting time. I definitely feel as though like there's been this move towards sleep has to be this really beneficial exercise or else you're not doing it right.
We all need more sleep. We just need to realize how important it is. And I think when we realize how important it is, then we'll each individually make changes. And as a result, the world will be a better place. Fingers crossed anyway.
The Search for Sleep there with Michelle Doyle and Alan Smeaton. The reporter was Anya Gallagher. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more Double Jobbing next Friday at 7. On Monday, the Daily Culture File awakens in its usual spot at 6:05 p.m. in Classic Drive. Till then, bye now.